Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
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 Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 13, text number 3 and 4. Tam
bandhum
agatam drishtva dharma putra sahanujaha dhritarashtro yuyutsus cha
suta
Charadvataha
Prata
Gandhari
Draupadi
Brahman Subhadra Chotara Kripi Anyas Cha Jamaya Pandor Gatayaha Sasutaha Striyaha
Tam
bandhum
agatam drishtva
Dharma putra sahanujaha Dhritarashtro yuyutsuscha Suta sharadvata prata Gandhari
Draupadi Brahman
Subhadra Chotara Kripi Anyascha Jamaya Pandor Gataya Sasutastriyaha
Sambandhur Bhagatam Drishtva
Draupadi Brahman Subhadra Chotara Kripi
Anyascha Jamaya Pandor
Anyascha Jamaya Pandor
Gataya Sasuta Sutashtriyaha
Gataya Sasutashtriyaha
Tambandhum Agatam Drishtva
Tambandhum Agatam Drishtva
Dharmaputraha Sahanujaha
Dharmaputraha
Ladies. Tam bandhum agatam drishtva.
Dharma putra
sahanujaha.
Dhritarashtro yuyutsuscha.
Dhritarashtra Yuyutsuska
Suta Sarabhaka Apika
Suta Sarabhaka Apika Gandhari Draupadi Brahman
Subhadra
Chotarakriti
Anyascha Jamaya Pandur Gyataya Sa Sutastriyaha
Tamantum Agatam Drishva Dharmaputra Sahanujaha Dhritarashtra Yuyutsuska Suta Sarabhata Prita Gandhari Draupadi Brahman
Subhadra
Chotarakriti Anyascha Jamaya Pandur Gataya sa sutastriyaha Tamantum agatam drishva Dharmaputra sahanujaha Dhritarashtra yuyutsuska Suta sarabhata prita Gandhari Draupadi Brahman Subhadra Chotarakriti Anyascha Jamaya Pandur Gyatayah Sasutastriyah
Tam Him Pandhum Relative Agatam, having arrived there. Drishtva, by seeing it. Dharmaputraha, Yudhishthira. Saha Anujaha,
along with his younger brothers.
Dhritarashtraha, Dhritarashtra.
Yuyutsuhu,
Satyaki.
Cha,
and
Sutaha
Sanjay
Sharadvataha
Kripacharja
Prita
Kunti
Gandhari
Gandhari
Draupadi
Draupadi
Brahman
O
Brahmanas
Subhadra
Subhadra
Cha
And
Uttara,
Uttara,
Kripi,
Kripi,
Anyaha,
Anyaha,
others,
Cha,
and
Jamayaha,
wives of other family members,
Pando,
of the Pandavas,
Gyatayaha,
family members,
Sa Sutaha,
along with their sons.
Striyaha,
the ladies. When they saw Vidur return to the palace, all the inhabitants, Maharaj Yudhishthir, his younger brothers, Dhritarashtra, Satyaki, Sanjay, Kripacharja, Kunti, Gandhari, Draupadi, Subhadra, Uttara, Kripi, and many other wives of the Kauravas, and other ladies with children, all hurried to him in great delight. It so appeared that they had regained their consciousness after a long period. Purport. Gandhari, the ideal chaste lady in the history of the world, she was the daughter of Maharaj Subal, the king of Gandhar, now Kandahar in Kabul, and in her maiden state she worshipped Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva is generally worshipped by Hindu maidens to get a good husband. Gandhari satisfied Lord Shiva and by his benediction to obtain 100 sons, she was betrothed to Dhritarashtra, despite his being blind forever. When Gandhari came to know that her would-be husband was a blind man, to follow her life companion, she decided to become voluntarily blind. So she wrapped up her eyes with many silk linens, and she was married to Dhritarashtra under the guidance of her elder brother, Shakuni. She was the most beautiful girl of her time, and she was equally qualified by her womanly qualities, which endeared every member of the Kaurava court. But despite all her good qualities, she had the natural frailties of a woman, and she was envious of Kunti when the latter gave birth to a male child. Both the queens were pregnant, but Kunti first gave birth to a male child. Thus, Gandhari became angry and gave a blow to her own abdomen. As a result, she gave birth to a lump of flesh only. But since she was a devotee of Vyasadeva, by the instruction of Vyasadeva, the lump was divided into 100 parts, and each part gradually developed to become a male child. Thus, her ambition to become the mother of 100 sons was fulfilled, and she began to nourish all the children according to her exalted position. When the intrigue of the Battle of Kurukshetra was going on, she was not in favor of fighting with the Pandavas. Rather, she blamed Dhritarashtra, her husband, for such a fratricidal war. She desired that the state be divided into two parts, for the sons of Pandu and her own. She was very affected when all her sons died in the Battle of Kurukshetra, and she wanted to curse Bhimasen and Yudhisthira, but she was checked by Vyasadeva. Her mourning over the death of Duryodhan and Dushasan before Lord Krishna was very pitiful, and Lord Krishna pacified her by transcendental messages. She was equally aggrieved on the death of Karna, and she described to Lord Krishna the lamentation of Karna's wife. She was pacified by Srila Vyasadeva when he showed her dead sons, then promoted to the heavenly kingdoms. She died along with her husband in the jungles of the Himalayas, near the mouth of the Ganges. She burned in a forest fire. Maharaj Yudhisthira performed the death ceremony of his uncle and aunt. Om Aganati Mirandhasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurin Militam Jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhistam Sthapitam Jena Bhutale Swayam Rupakada Mayam Tathati Shapadantikam Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Jatapadakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathan Vitamstam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sehitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakhan Vitamscha Hey Krishna Karuna Sindho Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kam Shana Gaurangi Radhe Brindavaneshwari Prishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vansha Kalpitarubhyascha Kripa Sindho Bhyayevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shiva Shadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. It's a feature of this first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam that Srila Prabhupada gives little life sketches of some of the important persons from the mentioned or described in the Mahabharata. An Indian audience can be expected to be familiar with all of these famous persons, but Westerners, of course, might not be or wouldn't be expected to know. So Srila Prabhupada gives these sketches, which I remember when we were first reading Srimad Bhagavatam, we found fascinating, these little historical descriptions. Here, some of the prominent persons in the Kaurava court are described, or actually now it's the Pandava court, but the court of Hastinapur. And especially Srila Prabhupada describes here some of the great ladies of the family, starting with Gandhari, who's an exceptional person. Her strength of character is practically unmatched. Her austerity, she's described elsewhere in Srimad Bhagavatam as a tapasvi. Her austerity, her devotion, her chastity, her, all of her good qualities are most ideal and admirable. So she's a leading person in the history of the Mahabharata. And as described here, she disagreed with her husband about these intrigues against the Pandavas. Such a contrast between these persons are there as ideal examples. Yad yadacharati shreshtas tad tadevetaro janaha sayat pramanam kurute logastad anuvartate. The such an example to be seen and followed according to one's ability. Not everyone will be Gandhari, but certainly the ideal is there. Now the modern ideal is some slut who's Yeah, I mean, we could name, you know, just like who are the, there's a list of five or seven chaste ladies. Maybe some of you know that mantra. Gandhari, Mandodari, Draupadi, Sita. What's the mantra? Bolie?
Ahalya Draupadi Sita Tara Mandodari Tata Panchakanya Smarentyam Mahapataka Nashanam.
One gets freed from all sinful reactions just by remembering the names of these great ladies. Now they remember the names of, we won't even name them. Yeah, actually we heard that the number one Google search or something was Paris Hilton, who's... without wanting to disparage her character, she's a far cry from Draupadi, Mandodari, and so on. And it's unfortunate that people don't understand the value of such exalted personal character. They don't even know what exalted person, they don't know what's up and what's down. That's the characteristic of Kali Yuga. So they think that, you know, why should we be like these oppressed Indian women? We could be like Paris Hilton or whatever. And they don't realize the value of such exalted character. There was even a there was an article by, what is her name, the editor of a feminist publication in India called Manushri. And what is her name? She's quite a noted writer these days. She wrote an article that came to my attention called.
Is it Anita Nesar?
No. I've forgotten her name. Madhuri something? Not Madhuri Dixit, I know that. Anyway, I've forgotten her name. But she wrote an article called Restraint as a Feminist Strategy, the purport of which was that you think that the feminist ideal of the liberated woman who does whatever she wants and mixes however she wants is a lousy strategy for Indian women. Because it puts you, and even for Western women, because it just makes you, you're complaining that they treat me like a sex object. They treat me as some, you know, a machine for their enjoyment. But then you make yourself available for that. After making yourself so cheap, then you complain that people treat me like I'm something cheap. Like some man was talking to a prostitute, and she said, "What do you think I am?" He said, "We already know what you are. Now we're just talking about the price." So it's unfortunate that in the Kali Yuga, women make themselves into exploitable objects and are then victimized. So in this article, she pointed out that by restraint, Indian women had a power position because they became admired. That a chaste woman is just like Draupadi. You know, they fought a war over her honor, over an insult to her honor. If she'd been the other kind of person, you know, so what? It's just an evening's entertainment. But such a respectable woman, such a admirable, chaste lady, for her to be insulted was worth fighting a war over. Sita Devi, worth fighting a war over. But even in ordinary dealings, and she gave various examples of women who, by their strength of character, by their devotion and chastity, basically, had power. They became powerful. We would say by their austerity, but also in public estimation or in the estimation of the village in which they lived or the family in which they lived, they had actual power because of their self-restraint. I was mentioning, we were discussing yesterday, that some American college students, women college students, caught on to the same idea and saw that, you know, we're just being used by our fellow students, by the fellows who were students, and to our total, we're just being exploited. And so they took the same strategy. They went chaste and became power. And they weren't Christians particularly. It's not that it was, you know, they were born again or something. They were just smart. These were leading Ivy League colleges, and some of the women got together and formed a society whose name I forget. And the basic principle was that we're not here for your use. We're here for our education, but not that kind of education. And so they went chaste, and you know, what would you say? The value of their stock went up. there was a debate between one of the leaders of that society and some liberated, you know, free and loose fellow student, and they both had their thing to say, and the free and loose girl was sassy and smart and so on, and so they had their debate. I didn't see the debate, but they asked students what they thought, and one student summed it up. He said that, you know, I really liked that girl, the sassy loose one. He said, but I'd marry the other girl. So ideal characters from Mahabharata. Yes.
Two comments. One is, I think someone should produce or TV show or write a plot called something like Real Housewives of the Royal Dynasties of Ancient India or Vedic India, something like that. And the second comment is that there's a famous Greek comedy, I think, called Lysistrata.
Lysistrata, yeah.
In which the women are upset that all the men are dying in these wars and everything, and then they deny sex to their husbands, and that's how they're able to control the state and put an end to the war.
Yeah. Lysistrata. But we won't add her name to the mantra. Yeah, Prabhupada, sometimes when people would come up with this stereotype of how Indian women are always oppressed, and so, then Prabhupada would give the example that, you know, how the two great wars in Indian history were fought over the honor of chaste women. Pritha, daughter of Maharaj Shurasena and sister of Vasudev, Lord Krishna's father. Later she was adopted by Maharaj Kuntibhoja, and hence she is known as Kunti. She is the incarnation of the success potency of the personality of Godhead. The heavenly denizens from the upper planets used to visit the palace of King Kuntibhoja, and Kunti was engaged for their reception. She also served the great mystic sage Durvasa, and being satisfied by her faithful service, Durvasa Muni gave her a mantra by which it was possible for her to call for any demigod she pleased. As a matter of inquisitiveness, she at once called for the sun god, who desired couplement with her, but she declined. But the sun god assured her immunity from virgin adulteration, and so she agreed to his proposal. As a result of this couplement, she became pregnant, and Karna was born by her. By the grace of the sun, she again turned into a virgin girl, but being afraid of her parents, she quitted the newly born child, Karna. After that, when she actually selected her own husband, she preferred Pandu to be her husband. Maharaj Pandu later wanted to retire from family life and adopt the renounced order of life. Kunti refused to allow her husband to adopt such life, but at last Maharaj Pandu gave her permission to become a mother of sons by calling some other suitable personalities. Kunti did not accept this proposal at first, but when vivid examples were set by Pandu, she agreed. Thus, by dint of the mantra awarded by Durvasa Muni, she called for Dharmaraj, and thus Yudhisthira was born. She called for the demigod Vayu, air, and thus Bhim was born. She called for Indra, the king of heaven, and thus Arjun was born. The other two sons, namely Nakula and Sahadev, were begotten by Pandu himself in the womb of Madri. Later on, Maharaj Pandu died at an early age, for which Kunti was so aggrieved that she fainted. Two co-wives, namely Kunti and Madri, decided that Kunti should live for the maintenance of the five minor children, the Pandavas, and Madri should accept the sati rituals by meeting voluntary death along with her husband. This agreement was endorsed by great sages like Shatashringa and others present on the occasion. Later on, when the Pandavas were banished from the kingdom by the intrigues of Duryodhan, Kunti followed her sons, and she equally faced all sorts of difficulties during those days. This is significant, that Nainam's Aswatantra Marhasi, according to Vedic culture, a woman should never be independent. So in her childhood, she's protected by her father, in her youth by her husband, and in old age by her sons. So Kunti chose to go to the forest along with her sons. During the forest life, one demon girl, Hidimbi, wanted Bhim as her husband. Bhim refused. But when the girl approached Kunti and Yudhishthir, they ordered Bhim to accept her proposal and give her a son. As a result of this combination, Ghatotkacha was born, and he fought very valiantly with his father against the Kauravas. In their forest life, they lived with a Brahmin family that was in trouble because of one Bakasura demon, and Kunti ordered Bhim to kill the Bakasura to protect the Brahmana family against troubles created by the demon. She advised Yudhishthir to start for the Panchal Desh. Draupadi was gained in the Panchal Desh by Arjuna. But by order of Kunti, all five of the Pandava brothers became equally the husbands of Panchali, or Draupadi. She was married with five Pandavas in the presence of Vyasadev. Kunti Devi never forgot her first child, Karna, and after Karna's death in the Battle of Kurukshetra, she lamented and admitted before her other sons that Karna was her eldest son prior to her marriage with Maharaj Pandu. Her prayers for the Lord after the Battle of Kurukshetra, when Lord Krishna was going back home, are excellently explained. Later, she went to the forest with Gandhari for severe penance. She used to take meals after each 30 days. She finally sat down in profound meditation and later burned to ashes in a forest fire. We have that book, Teachings of Queen Kunti, where these prayers are elaborated, which of course appear in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Now that book can be distributed very widely so that people will get some idea of the ideal nature of such a woman as Kunti Devi. Anything else here?
Mm-hmm. Is there a reason behind the forest, death with the forest fire?
Reason behind the death in the forest fire? Trying to remember. Does someone remember their Mahabharat history? Yes?
I recently studied the Mahabharata, so
okay.
it was said that Dhritarashtra and the Brahmin, they did a yajna, fire sacrifice, and the fire sacrifice, there was some neglect in the fire sacrifice, and then it catches the fire to the forest, and everybody by knowingly actually, it is not actually a forest fire, which Vyasadeva said, it is actually the yajna, and they burned into ashes. Then Yudhishthir Maharaj came there and he was inquiring, and the great personality like Vyasadeva, and they said, can you believe that your father and mother or your uncle and aunt will die in a forest fire? It is not possible. It is just the yajna and the divine arrangement of the Lord. They born into the ashes. That is the...
So it's the same forest fire in which Dhritarashtra and Kantari perished. Yes. In Bhagavatam, the account is given that by mystic power, Dhritarashtra himself produced the fire. Yes. By austerity, they could become so powerful that they could do that. Anything else? Is that okay? Yes.
Maharaj, regarding sati, so I'm not able to understand what, why sati was in the Vedic times.
Why it was there. The chaste wife would feel such separation that for her to go on living was not as, would be more painful than dying along with her husband. So voluntarily, she would embrace death along with her husband, Sahamaran. There have been some modern examples. I think when that Titanic sank, then some of the women, when they came to know that their husband had drowned, then they also thought, then why should I live? And they also gave up their lives. Of course, they had to give up their lives anyway. That's another story. But of course, everyone has to give up their life. Voluntarily or involuntarily, everyone has to die. But these ideal women would think that, all right, if my husband is gone, then let me go also. Prabhupada mentioned that even in his experience, as late as the 1940s or something, he knew the there was one instance of the wife of one physician of his acquaintance who also preferred to die along with her husband. But as Prabhupada pointed out, it later became something by force, either to enforce some misdirected, misconceived religious idea, or as an economic expedient. You know, if she... if we cook her today, then we don't have to pay for her tomorrow. Or for whatever other reason, they would force the girl.
They made it a family honor.
Excuse me?
They made it a family honor.
Yeah, a matter of family honor, and you know, and the, but the girl wouldn't be willing. So they would drug her or tie her down or both. So that became a criminal affair, and it was justifiably outlawed by the British. But in cases like those mentioned here, it was entirely voluntary. Even Dhritarashtra's death was voluntary. He previously had gone, had been living in the palace of the Pandavas. Vidura said, like a dog, like a household dog. No, very seriously, that you're living a degraded life just for the sake of living, getting your food and some prestige. You're living here taking scraps of food thrown to you by Bhima, who killed your most beloved sons. Your teeth are loose, your liver isn't working, you've been blind from birth, your hearing is going, and still you're going to live as the royal uncle of Yudhisthira Maharaj. How degraded it is. So it would be better if you would go off to the forest and die like a man. You know, die for spiritual realization rather than live for a misdirected sense of sense gratification. So, by the grace of Mahatma Vidura, Dhritarashtra did that. He voluntarily embraced, well, forest life means, first it's the forest and then it's death. It's understood that going to the forest means that the next step is dying. Or the Pandavas went to the Himalayas. You know, that means you're going to freeze to death, or one way or another you're going to die. So they voluntarily preferred that. Let me die for spiritual realization rather than live for sense enjoyment. You can contrast the modern ideal. Now in the modern world, it's just understood that when my husband dies, I should wait a decent interval, you know, at least a few months, you know, maybe it's a year or so, whatever it is. And then after a decent period of mourning, then I should dress nice and start marketing myself. And then they become, you know, they get a second marriage and a third marriage. And they're, you know, what is their, what, why, for what? It's simply for sense enjoyment. And for a false security. So the Vedic idea was different, that life is not meant for illusory sense gratification, illusory sense enjoyment. Everyone else can check their mobiles too if you haven't already. Okay, just that. We have time, we keep reading? Or should we stop here?
It's keep reading a little more.
Okay, there only is a little more, actually. Oh no, there's a lot more. There's Draupadi and there's Subhadra. So, shall we read Draupadi? Or should we stop here? It's quite a long purport.
Maybe there's some general questions.
Okay, some questions? Yes. Great chapter, by the way. One of my favorite chapters of Srimad Bhagavatam.
I didn't understand the idea of voluntarily giving the body, say, because there's a line of difference of getting frustrated and giving the body, and there's a line of, say, getting frustrated with the body.
I don't follow.
There's a line of, say, getting frustrated with the situations around the body, and then, I mean, I want to quit. And there's another argument saying that, okay, for high spiritual realization, but I didn't understand the second thing.
There's okay, no one's screaming. I guess we're okay. First of all, it wasn't just a question of frustration. Because that's also mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, that if we just do things out of frustration, out of how we feel, and so on, then it's in the mode of passion and ignorance. You know, I feel like I should kill myself, and then I kill myself. It's not like that I attain the heavenly planets. I become a ghost. Because it's simply out of passion or out of ignorance. It's out of frustration or anger or political purpose or what have you. But there's authorized suicide, actually. Even, we're speaking about women, for men also, Dhritarashtra is the example, or others, it's described that at the time when death is imminent, then rather than just drag on and drag on and drag on and drag on, there's a process one can stop eating, one can stop everything and basically voluntarily go. At that point, it's no longer suicide in a reprehensible sense. It's just, you know, accepting the inevitable and not like in chess, you know, where the game is over and you don't wait till the last move. You just resign because it's understood that's where it is. You know, why drag it out? So Dhritarashtra did that. And otherwise, the most authorized form of suicide is called sannyas, where one gives up his material life, gives up his material family, gives up his material comfort, gives up his, you know, his everything, material possessions. So that means death. That means death. So that's voluntary death, sannyas. Rather than wait for death to overtake us,
you know, die at home, nursed by our relatives or some hired people. And we're spending our days just bouncing our grandchildren on our knee. One is advised to voluntarily die by accepting sannyas. Sitvatmapatam grihamandakupam panam kato yat harimashrayeta. That now I've been taking shelter of Maya for so many years. Now I've been taking shelter of the arrangements of the material energy. So now let me voluntarily end that and take shelter of Krishna. Go to the forest. They used to go to the forest and take shelter of Krishna. So that's dying before dying. Dying to live. Absolutely. Is it possible or practical now? Absolutely. Srila Prabhupada accepted sannyas.
Not sannyas, but the first form.
Use the microphone, please.
Not sannyas, but the other form, going to the forest and then...
Vrindavan is there. That's a forest. Yes, one is advised. Don't stay at home till your last days.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
But there is a popular saying in India that husband and wife meets for seven lives. And you know...
That's popular, of course.
I don't know whether it's right or wrong, but I keep hearing that wife dies in sati because she likes to get the same husband in next life. Hmm. And in that way, she takes the husband and wife takes seven lives, and after they get liberation or something like that.
Better that they should finish it in one life. The idea is that the husband is like the spiritual master of the wife, and he should be aiming toward a higher destination. And by following the husband, the wife will also attain that same destination. That's the idea. The best destination is back to Godhead. Yad gatva nani vartante tad dhamma paramam. Prabhupada said, finish it in one life.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Yeah. Thank you.
Maharaj, like when we preach this to like open publicly, like I was in Sankirtan Palo Alto a couple of months before, and I was telling one lady, she's like giving the higher test book and saying, if your mother cooks and it is very, there is love in it and all those things. She told, why you are giving example, my mother?
I don't understand.
She asked me why you are giving example of my mother.
Uh-huh.
Like I told, mother is like supreme, and I don't like my mother. You should not give example of.
Yeah, this is Western culture, Indian culture. The parents are worshipped. What is that? Deva Dvija Guru Pragya Pujanam. In the Bhagavad Gita, it said that this is austerity in the mode of goodness, that superiors, like the demigods, the Lord, the Guru, the Brahmins, and the mother and father, they should be offered puja. They should be worshipped. Even we see in the so many ways. Maharaj Yudhisthira set the example that every day he would first thing, he would visit the elders and touch their feet. So the so much respect is there for parents. And it's there in Western culture. In the Bible, it said, honor thy mother and thy father. But how do they do it? Get off my back, Mom, will ya? You know? It's so... So much the opposite. So what kind of culture is it? You know, they yell at their mother and treat her like, you know, beat their wives, yell at their mothers. You know, what is it? So they don't have the idea what culture is, actually. They don't have the idea what culture is. And the mothers also so often don't have the idea with what culture is. So they're, you know, what kind of mothers they are is another question. You know, I don't like my mother. Chances are he may have good reason also. But the ideal is there of motherhood, and how much respect is there for the mother. But if you give that example to the Western people, yeah, they may not get it. I can tell you in an Indian context, I'll tell you a book distribution story. There's one devotee, Kamalapati. He's one of the very top book distributors in Mayapur. They go traveling and so on. So he'll distribute a book. He'll show the book to someone. He'll say, you know, what's more important to you, your money or your mother? So, of course, the person says, well, my mother is more important. So then he says, well, this is a book for your mother. She'll definitely like this book and tell something about the book. Finally, the person says, well, all right, how much is it? So he says the price, and the person says, well, he says, but it's for your mother. Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, these days, like fortunately with Prabhupada and association, we understand like as women, like what our position is and all that. But generally, when we talk to people who are not Krishna conscious, women being like equally to men, because making money and they want to administer and all those qualities, they want to control, even in all fields of life. So the relationship even at home is not based on love, or husband is like elder to me, or it's not based on that.
No.
So they think that they also have equal rights. So in that sense, if people think like that, even to talk about all these things, they think that they're primitive and things like that.
The same examples may not work when you're trying to explain something. But if we examine the situation, you know, examples aside, you know, I gave some example. Well, just like, you know, in the army, you know, you act according to orders. But the guy was a pacifist, so the example didn't go over very well. So we may sometimes have to adjust. But in terms of the situation, you know, what is their freedom? Their freedom is, Prabhupada said, that you become, you know, they mix like anything. And then when she becomes pregnant, Prabhupada said, now you have freedom. You can kill your child, or you can go beg from the government. What kind of freedom is that? And from another point of view, yeah, now we have equal earning power, we can do everything. And so the guy, you know, the natural mentality of a man is to be protective. The nature of a woman is to take shelter, and the nature of the man is to give shelter. That natural sentiment is there. Therefore, you see in the movies, you know, there's some dacoit or some ghost or something, and then the girl's going, and the guy is there, don't worry. Anyway, when you smash that, then it's like, okay, so we'll stay together as long as it's nice. And when it's not nice anymore, that is to say when the girl gets a little older and she doesn't look so hot anymore, then the guy chucks her. When she was 18, 20, 25, then it was really great to have her as a wife or a girlfriend. It's more or less the same thing these days. But now when she's like 35, you know, it's like, would you want to ride around in a 15-year-old car? Of course not. You want the latest model, all shiny and new. So he takes his wife of 10 years or 15 years or 25 years and dumps her and gets a nice, shiny new one. That's become common these days. the women who are devoted to, the psychology is very good, that the Indian women practically control their husbands because they're devoted, because they're chaste. So the guy is, can't just say, get lost, because she's rendered so much service. Service means obligation. Service means obligation. If I accept service, then I feel obligated. I have to do something now. What is it? The favor bank, right? You did something for me, I have to do something for you. So what to speak of the devoted wife who serves her husband, and serves the family? There's a great debt created there. So even if he doesn't like her, he can't give her up. Okay, there may be so many shiny new ones, but this one has served me so faithfully for so many years, and she's dependent on me. But when she's independent and does what she wants and so on and so on, then the guy's, hey, you've got your own money. Take care of yourself. And from a practical point of view, when a guy is like 25 and a girl is, 18 or 20, her market value is way up and his market value is fairly low. He's just finishing school, maybe paying off his student loans, looking for starting a career. So he's still an iffy proposition. But she's fantastic. Looks good, walks good, dresses good. Everything about her is like dynamite. All the charm and magic is there. So her value is way up there. Now, when he's 40 or 50 and she's 40 or 50, his market value is sky high. He's got money in the bank. He's got stocks. He's got investments. He's got, a career. He's got, maybe he's got a political position. He's got influence. He's got so many things. His stock has gone up. And what has she got? Wrinkles and, health complaints and extra weight and... and two or three kids. So that makes her a real hot commodity on the marriage market, right? An old lady with health problems, wrinkles, fat, and three kids from her previous marriage. I mean, that's not exactly a great proposition. So when you set it up that, we come and go as we like, and, we're sort of like, we try it out for a while, and, we don't even, why even get married? We just live together because, it's based on, how we all want to have an exit door. So then when she's 35 or 40 or 50, he takes the exit door and she's left begging. And for him, it's no problem. He'll pick up, he'll drive around in his Maserati or something and pick up the first young girl he sees. And she's got a career. So it's set up in such a way that the women are getting the short end of the stick and they're asking for it. Yeah, it's great. 50% of the marriages divorce. And for the second marriage, the percentage is higher. And the family means the children are like, I meet kids on the plane, where are you going? I'm going to Dallas. What's in Dallas? My daddy. Right? So sometimes they're with their mommy, sometimes they're with their daddy, and they're all screwed up. So what happiness have they gotten? Nasa siddham avapnoti nasukam na paramgatim. Krishna says, you neglect the directions of Shastra, you won't become perfect. You won't become happy, and you won't go back to Godhead. So what do you get? So people think, that by ranging their own, you know, those poor Indian women, blah, 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 or, you know, the way it used to be, blah, 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 and all that tradition, blah, 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 and all this repression, blah, blah, blah. But actually, they have happiness. You know, the women who are living in an Indian village and following the old tradition, they have more happiness than your modern American female corporate executive. So they may find that. Even there was an article in a major newspaper recently that the previous generation of women sort of looked at divorce as a creative opportunity. And, you know, it was kind of like, well, I'm divorcing my husband. Well, it's about time, you know, you stood up to that guy, you know, after all he's put you through and blah, 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 blah. So it's kind of like, hey, good going, Susie. And now the next generation of women, it's like, well, I'm divorcing my husband. Oh. It doesn't have the same prestige anymore because these women who are talking about it are the daughters of divorced parents. So they know what it means. So it's not as cool anymore as it was. So this is the experimental method. We try this, we try that, but it doesn't work. If we follow Krishna's direction, it works. Mm-hmm. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, I just wanted to know the goal of a person to go back to Godhead, is it the same as a person attaining moksha or liberation?
It's better.
So that means that there will not be any rebirth and kind of thing when we say that we going back to Godhead?
Absolutely. Yadgatva nanivartante tadhama paramam mama.
But actually in Vaishnava philosophy, we keep hearing that one should be praying for being born again.
That's Prahlad Maharaj, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Prabhupada said, we're not on their level, we want to go back.
Because
but apart from that, even if someone wants to come back, that's voluntary.
No.
He's liberated, but he wants to come back for the benefit of others. That's different from you have to come back. Just like, you know, the thief is thrown in jail, that's one thing. The governor visits the jail, that's another. So the conditioned life means we're like the thieves, we're thrown in jail. And liberated life, he doesn't have to come back to jail, but out of compassion he may sometimes come for the benefit of others. That's different, entirely different.
I was confused because we were told to keep praying that we have to keep coming back so that we can serve the Lord every time.
The point is that our goal is not to attain liberation. Our goal is service. The impersonalists, their only goal is to get liberation. Material life is so much suffering. Let me get free from material life. And their idea of what that means, in the case of the Buddhists, it's to become void, dismantle my personal existence. And in the case of the impersonalists or the followers of Shankara, it's to become one with Brahma, to merge with the Supreme, which is really another version of the Buddhist conclusion, because again, my individuality is extinguished. So, but although my individuality is extinguished, at least I'm not suffering anymore. So it's kind of spiritual suicide. I'll kill my spiritual individuality, but at least that will free me from my material suffering. That's their moksha. So that moksha, kaivalyam narakayate, is viewed as by the Vaishnavas as being hellish. Because there's no opportunity for loving exchanges with Krishna. There's no opportunity for service to Krishna. There's just a sort of limp merging. So yes, that merging means freedom from birth and death, but it's unconstitutional, and therefore even that doesn't last. Ruyakrishchena paramparam tata patantyato nadrati yusmanak. Because they're neglecting their eternal... Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur uses the phrase holding their individuality in abeyance. You know, forcibly suppressing their individuality. You can't actually extinguish it because Krishna says that there's no change for the soul and the soul is individual. It doesn't change and suddenly become non-individual. Abhikaryo yamuchate. Krishna says, I'm eternal, I always existed, you always existed, these kings and princes always existed, we'll all exist in the future also. That means individuality. So one may try to hold that individuality in abeyance, but it comes back. It comes back because it's constitutional. So the devotee is rather than try to get moksha by suppressing or obliterating individuality, come to their real individuality. Muktirhitvanyata rupam swarupena vyavastita. They give up their false ego, but they come to the point of real ego. I'm not this body, I'm not a part of this material world, but I am the eternal servant of Krishna. So they're in the postgraduate stage of liberation. They're beyond liberation. They're better than liberated. Akurana, well, okay, yes, you're next to the microphone. Well, the microphone is with you, so microphone
Hare
rules.
Krishna Maharaj, thank you very much. I had one question, like, you know, our generation, so when we were small, you know, the whole India was very conservative that time. Hmm. You know, I remember my wife was never allowed to work. Even she was asked to go to a college where only girls were.
Hmm. And just while I'm thinking of it, even in America, you know, some, or India also, some years back, if your wife was working, it's like, what's wrong with her husband? You know, why should she have to work? I mean, her husband was in difficulty. Some years ago, it was tracked by the American Census Department. If a man and woman were working, both, it's because they were really stuck. He was poor, and so she had to work. It meant, you know, the difficulty for the children. It meant difficulty for her. But, you know, she had to do it. Now, if a husband and wife work, it's to maintain their lifestyle. You know, they need two incomes for the level of comfort they're accustomed to. And the woman is the loser, and the children are the big losers. The children are the big losers. They don't get the motherly affection. They don't get the attention of the mother. They just get, you know, passed off somewhere because they're in the way. But go ahead, I interrupted.
Yeah, I think you actually went super fast on that, my question highway, and you answered part of it. So my dilemma was, Maharaj, like, there was a situation where women are not even allowed to do, but her father said, okay, you do whatever in your husband's house. Hmm. And now, you know, my home is also, you know, we are a bit open, but not, like, when we came here, now I was always thinking, how shall I support her in, you know, getting... Now, that's one extreme, and when they are interacting with other ladies, they always feel kind of, you know, I have to do this because other ladies are working.
Yeah,
right?
it's their misfortune.
Yeah.
It's a kind of misfortune. There was something else in regard to that. Oh, there's a very intelligent Jewish lady. She lives in Israel, and she has a blog that someone pointed me to. She started her blog before she got married. Now she's married. She has two kids. And her history was that she was a feminist with the, you know, the whole feminist thing and the sleeping around and all of that. And she, at some point, got it, that this doesn't work, and went the other way, became religious and chaste and so on. And now she's been writing this blog for so many years, and she's been talking about her married life and her husband and family affairs and so on. But she's a very smart lady, and she's got sometimes talks about, you know, what is it, you know, for you young girls who are where I was, what's the story here? Or even for, like, young mothers, what's the story? And she analyzed, okay, you're working, but what are you getting? You have to pay for your transportation now. You have to pay for your eating costs have gone up because now you're not eating at home. You're eating at work or you're eating out, so that's gone up. Your cost for, you know, you have to have a uniform or whatever it is. You got to pay for that. Parking, gas, tolls, all of that. Other costs associated with work, maybe additional education, additional training, you're paying for that. And finally, you're paying for child support, for child care. You know, so you're doing all of this work. What are you actually taking home?
Yeah.
You know, just do a, you know, on a straight economic analysis, what are you really getting? For all that trouble, how much are you getting? And then what are you losing? You know, you don't get to spend time with your kids. Your kids don't get the benefit of your, attention. And you've got to deal, you know, all the guff that a guy has to take. You know, you got to deal with the boss, you got to deal with the coworkers, you got to deal with this, you got to deal with that, you got to deal with customers, you got to deal with blah, blah, blah. You bought into all that. Lucky you. You get to nurse your kids by pumping milk out with a machine. You know, what is that? So she did the analysis and said, you know, okay, work if you want to, but let's do a real cost-benefit analysis before we go off to work.
So Maharaj, that's where it was coming. So the analysis for people like us who are in midstream, the only solution seems to be going back to India.
That's a great idea. Vaisheshika Prabhu is not giving his permission. Okay. But there are other solutions. It's not that there's only India or death. But it's radical. You know what the biggest solution is? My expenses get cut. This is another business analysis. That which is easier to do? Increase your income or decrease your expenditure? Decrease your expenditure is always easier. Because to make money, you have to spend money. So to make a dollar, you have to spend so many dollars, or you have to spend so much. And pay, you have to pay taxes. You know, there's so much to actually get some money. To get a dollar is tough, especially in the present climate. But to cut a dollar off your expenses, that's just a matter of your own austerity, your own willpower, your own determination to do it. And that's one reason, actually, why most Indians and Asians are ahead of their Western counterparts, because they still, you know, they have an idea that I can cut my expenses, I can live on less, I'll live with my parents, I'll, you know, whatever it is to keep the expense down. Well, meanwhile, the Western kids are going into debt. So anyway, applying that same principle, it's not, well, India or nothing, but one can always radically screw down one's expenses. Whatever they are, they can go further down. My food expense. We were talking the other day, Vaisheshika Prabhu and I were talking the other day. Some guy in a Los Angeles suburb had a little house, you know, not but your ordinary little house with a little bit of turf around it, and just took every inch of the turf and grew something he could eat. Grew something, you know, and like India, you grow something on the roof, you grow something every place. the guy became 100% self-sufficient on his food for himself and his family. That's not the end of it. He had plenty left over so that he could invite his neighbors over for, you know, dinner. And he had enough so that he could sell the excess at the local market. I think it was organic on top of that, so, you know, high prices. So he had extra money from that. He didn't need a car anymore because he didn't have to go to work. And for entertainment, he would invite his friends over and they would play music or, you know, do something like old times sake when people used to just get together and be friends and they didn't have to spend $100 to go have a good time. You know, because what does a person need? He needs clothing, he needs shelter, and he needs food. So he solved his food issue, you know, right on his little piece of land. And Americans are so, you know, they'll have a tree and it'll give fruits, and they'll say, yeah, but they're not very good fruits, and they'll go buy fruits at the, you know, the whatever the market is. So that's the thing you can do. You can, before you say, well, she has to work because look at your expenses, and say, can I knock my expenses down?
Just to have my personal experience, 2 years ago, my wife used to work in Microsoft. Mm. And then finally we decided to quit the job. It was a little pain. But, you know, by Krishna's arrangement, she got laid off. That's a good thing, good sign of Krishna. So
made the decision easier, right?
Now it's a good thing. So we don't need to search for a job. And she started homeschooling for my kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I think by the time I feel that really even one income is sufficient enough in Krishna's mercy that you really do not need two income to sustain as long as you are satisfied and what you wanted to do. If you're too greedy that I wanted to have BMW, I am to have so many cars or so different things, then definitely two income. But one income is sufficient enough and you can be really peaceful Krishna consciousness family. That's my personal experience.
Thank you very much.
Maharaj, just to follow up on that, it's not an argument, Maharaj, but just these days, if we are not at a higher level of Krishna consciousness, maybe it's not a bad idea for women to work, because in olden days, like they didn't have any machines.
Well, women they were not at a higher level of Krishna. Okay, go ahead and finish that argument.
So what I'm saying is, like, even to make small things, women used to work physically, like to get some water and all that, but now you open the tap, you get water. Mm. Even cooking is not such a difficult thing. Mm. So if you're not doing anything else, like if you're not Krishna conscious, even free time, if you're Krishna conscious, you tend to go on the web and all that. Mm. But at least if you keep yourself busy by working and interacting with people, at least you're in anxiety and you're forced to depend on Krishna when you're
really
in trouble.
If you really have that problem, if your problem is just, I have too much free time, distribute books.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Actually, I wanted to put my observation. Actually, Roji, Maharaj, sorry.
Just one more thing about that. Yeah, we have free time because it's so easy to cook, because we just take something that we bought in the market. We open the can, which takes 2 minutes. We throw it in the microwave, which takes 4 minutes, and that's dinner. But you know that's. And that also makes the wife very replaceable, because I can open my own damn can.
Maharaj, initially, women used to get married very early, at the age of 12 or 14, and they used to get children at very early age. And then
they still do. They still do all the rest of it at a very early age. They just don't get married.
Like
like now government have put this age bars for women to get married, and in that way she's getting educated more, and as she's getting educated more, she's thinking of career and things like that. So how can we manage, because like government
the government Prabhupada said they can you know, if it's illegal to get married, you know, this is my girlfriend, but actually they're married. Yeah, anyone can get around the government. That's Hare Krishna. But yeah. But actually, it's a better. You know, they complain the women. You know, they need child marriage, blah blah blah. And, you know, she does. One of my godbrothers wanted to get married, and Prabhupada arranged. There was one of my god sisters who was unmarried. She was a high school girl. She was 17, 18. And there was sort of an agreement made, but the mother objected. The mother said, no, she's too young. She should get to know many boys and have a little more experience, and then she can, you know, get married. Prabhupada said, just see, the mother wants the daughter to become a prostitute. Yeah, the mothers are very happy if their daughter is popular. You know, what does popular mean? And people are spending what, $30,000 a year to send their daughter to college to be used by the boys, and that's education. What education is that? Okay, she's got a degree and she can, you know, go for a career and so on, but where's her happiness? You know, what is that? I have a. We have to, who knows Mahamantra from Delhi? Any of you? Okay. You're very sort of fast-talking guy, very slick, very sharp lawyer. He can walk into the government office of any big, you know, the secretary of this, the minister of that, and talk to him for 10 minutes and say thank you very much and walk out with whatever he aimed at. Very capable guy. And you meet his wife. And she's a simple village girl. You know his wife? Yeah. Right? She's a simple village girl. I don't think she even speaks English. Maybe she's learned some English now, but she hardly knows any English. Because his father, her father approached his father and, you know, is your son interested in getting married? So Mahamantra's father approached him and said, you know, this offer is there. Are you interested? He said, is she educated? Father said, no. He said, I'll take her. Brilliant kids, yeah. Very smart move.
We see there was a custom in this. We're hearing about these Kshatriya princesses, and that they would be able to select their husband in a Swayamvara ceremony. Mm. Sometimes we hear people complain that their parents arrange some marriage. I've recently been reading a book by this Somali woman, Ayan Hirsi Ali, who, you know, she escaped some arranged marriage with a man that she didn't really have, you know, that, and she talked about other Muslim women who found, you know, their husband has an offensive smell, he's, you know, there's different things that they're, somehow they're thrown into a marriage with somebody that they're not happy with.
They all have offensive smells, by the way. Everybody's husband has an offensive smell. That's the judgment of Rukmini, that anyone who doesn't have Krishna as her husband is married to a bag of mucus, bile, and air. With some hair on his head and some mustache on his face. Yes.
But isn't that a contradiction of the woman that can't stand to stay alive anymore, that her in the absence of her husband? And
yeah, I mean, there's abuse on every side, especially in Kali Yuga. It's not that arranged marriage means automatically everybody enters into the heavenly planets. There is abuse. There's marriage for simple you know, in exchange for a refrigerator or something like that. There can be arrangements for the sort of crassest reasons and without consideration. So everything can be abused. But you know the Latin that abuse doesn't invalidate proper usage? It's a Latin proverb.
I should know it, but I'm blanking. Okay. It must be a legal maxim, right?
You know, well, I'm sure the law must have grabbed onto it. But yeah, abuse is something usum. Anyway, the abuse of the thing doesn't invalidate proper use. So in the proper system, just like we read about Devahuti. So it wasn't just that her father, Manu, said, you know, I got a guy and he's good and I like him and you got to marry him. You know, the girl was consulted. What was her feeling in the matter? What was her preference? And the father was seeing to it not out of, well, I got this girl and I got to dump her, but out of love for the daughter to see that she was nicely situated. And then she got such a qualified husband as Kardam Muni and son, Kapil Dev, the personality of Godhead. So the real system is like that. It's not just that of a desire to be, you know, to get rid of her or something like that. Therefore, it's said that it was considered a form of charity to give one's daughter to a qualified husband was considered to a very meritorious act, an act of charity, to give a highly qualified daughter to suitably qualified man. It wasn't just we got this girl, we got to dump her.
Kanyadan.
So the proper understanding, like everything has to be done with the right consciousness, with the right understanding, with the right care, with the right attention.
But this idea that there can be, like, for example, you're talking about how the British properly outlawed the
sati,
you know, the criminal, you know, involuntary formality of sati for family honor or for some other reason. And a lot of times we read about these people who are of the highest ideals, and then people who are up to no good, who are abusing the system. Why aren't you like Sati? Why aren't you like Sita? Yeah. Why aren't you like Draupadi?
Why aren't you like Rob?
Yeah, right, exactly. So the hypocrisy gets there, and the people who aren't maybe not necessarily interested in Krishna consciousness or spiritual values, but still hate what they can perceive as injustice, then they criticize religion because they say, oh, religion is being used by hypocrites to pursue this inequity and injustice.
So we'll get irreligion. We'll get rid of religion, and then we'll have what we have. You know, take America, okay? We've basically dumped religion. And have the women become happy.
Well, Maharaj, it works the other way. Abuse doesn't necessarily mean... that there's no proper use. There may be a proper use.
Therefore, the real thing is not this system or that system. It's Krishna consciousness. If there's Krishna consciousness and it's properly arranged, it'll be good. Or if there's Krishna consciousness, even if she's choosing her own husband, it will be good. If there's no Krishna consciousness, nothing will work.
Agreed.
Stop here, continue, tell us what are my orders. Good.
Jai Advaita Maharaj is an international treasure in ISKCON and with Vaishnavas all over the world, wherever they are, and people in general. And he's been serving Prabhupada faithfully since practically the beginning of the movement. And just to have you here to visit is one of our greatest assets every year. And we'd like to thank you from the bottom of our hearts for taking time out to come to spend some time with us, to encourage us, and to answer our questions.
Please give him a...
From all of us, thank you for carrying on Prabhupada's parampara. For those of you who don't know, one of Prabhupada's statements about Jai Advaita Maharaj when he was doing a service, he said, Jai Advaita means parampara. Hare Krishna. So thank you very much for all that you're doing and being a pillar that is supporting this Krishna consciousness movement. Hare Krishna.
Thank you, Vaisheshika Prabhu. But the real thing is that, you know, I come here for inspiration. There's such an ideal standard set here by Vaisheshika Prabhu, such an ideal leader, and the devotees here are such enthusiastic devotees that I get inspiration by coming, and I get renewal and new ideas. So then whatever I've got, I get here once a year, that's what I take back with me to Africa. So practically whatever I'm able to do in Africa, I'm indebted to you for that, because here's where I come to get ideas and inspiration and the right line of priority and the right line of action. Thanks to all of you, and especially to Vaisheshika Prabhu.
Jai Advaita Swami Maharaj ki jai. Gaur Premanande Hari Bol.
Vaisheshika Prabhu ki jai. Samaveta Bhaktavrinda ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Gaur Premanande.
So let us put away all the books as efficiently, as respectfully as possible. And then put all the way the asans. Did you have the early Guru Puja? Or are you having Guru Puja now? No. Okay, and then we'll have Guru Puja for Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.